Hey, Token CEO listeners, you can find every episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Frankie just muted me, the producer. She fucks up every episode. It's like a gift. It's an art, actually. It's Thursday, June 3rd. This is episode 159 of the Token CEO podcast. We are presented by Sports Research. Sports Research makes this podcast possible. They provide all sorts of workout gear, workout equipment. They make sweet sweat sticks. They help you enhance your vitamin and your workout routine. Professional athletes from the UFC to the NFL have used Sweet Sweat. Bloggers here use Sweet Sweat. I think Brianna Chicken Fry uses Sweet Sweat. If you are on the fence about trying something from Sports Research, you can go to sportsresearch.com, use code TOKEN to get 30% off your order. And if you want even more incentive, you can go to sportsresearch.com, use code NRC at checkout, and get yourself a free stick of Sweet Sweat. So today's episode, first of all, let's give a shout out to Naomi Osaka. If you can imagine yourself at 23 years old, or maybe you are 23, and you just gave a big fuck you to one of the biggest tournaments out there because you don't want to talk to the media. You called the bluff of all the old white men who run the circuit, and you're like, no, I'm not doing this. It's not good for my mental health. It's not where I want to be. It's not what I want to be doing. I give that woman a ton of credit. I think it is audacious. I think it's bold. I think it's controversial. I've been debating, you know, is she in the right or is she wrong to not want to talk to the media? I think she is raising awareness of the fact that it is very personal for these athletes, and to be criticized through questions about your play can in fact affect your play itself. I also think she's a woman who's made a ton of money. I think she has over a $50 million contract, and she's like, screw you guys, I don't need this. I'm going to wait till I get on a surface that I can play better on, and I'm going to win there. So I give her a huge amount of credit just for the boldness of what she's doing and also the fearlessness with which she is doing it. So speaking of bold and fearless women, we have a very special guest today. I have been hunting down this guest forever. Barry Weiss joins us. So Barry Weiss, as you may or may not know, was an opinion writer and editor from 2013 to 2017 at the Wall Street Journal. And then from 2017 to 2020, she was an op-ed staff editor and writer about culture and politics at the New York Times. So the woman has worked at the most prestigious news and journalism brands out there. So what's interesting about Barry Weiss is, first of all, she was hired by the New York Times in an effort to, quote unquote, broaden the ideological range of its opinion staff after the inauguration of President Trump. So she was brought in because her views were different from the majority of the newsroom. That was a fairly short-lived stint. Barry made it 3 years at the Times. It was widely reported about how hated she was in the newsroom. She also was quite vocal herself, including the publication of her resignation letter, where she said about the New York Times, "Stories are chosen and told in a way to satisfy the narrowest of audiences, rather than to allow a curious public to read about the world and draw their own conclusions. If a piece is perceived at the New York Times as likely to inspire backlash internally or on social media, the editor or writer avoids pitching it. If she feels strongly enough to suggest it, she's quickly steered to safer ground." Okay, this is what Barry is saying about one of the most esteemed news brands in the world. I think it's somewhat ironic where, if I'm remembering the ads correctly, the New York Times likes to take out like full page ads and bus and subway marketing that says they're about the truth, when really what her experience was something quite different. Barry's joining us to talk about her Substack newsletter, life after the New York Times, how she got to where she is today and where she's going next. And then finally, what her opinion is around the closing and narrowing of what's acceptable, aka cancel culture. Okay, it is an honor to talk to you. I think you are such a badass. Like, I'm just very excited about this. So thank you for doing it. Okay, great. My first question, and then I'm going to want to go back and get into like who you are, where you came from. I want to talk about your family in Pittsburgh. I want to talk about the New York Times. I want to know everything about the Slack channel inside the New York Times. And then obviously what you're doing next. But my first question is, what is it about you that pisses people off so much?
You don't have to tell me, because this is the first question everyone asks me, including at this point my own family. And it's just it's a mystery to me. The closest thing that I've sort of, the closest answer that I've come to that seems somewhat plausible is that, you know, in a lot of ways, I, you know, look like I should have a certain set of political ideas. I live in those kinds of neighborhoods. I eat at those kinds of restaurants. I'm married to a woman. You know, I'm politically progressive. You know, if you kind of look down the list of issues that I care about, on many of them, I'm progressive. But I think because of the fact that there's something in my personality that is somehow contrarian or not willing to go along with every tenet of what I think of as this new orthodoxy or this new dogma, almost like a new religion, I think there's special outrage and anger reserved for those people, even more so than there are for those on, you know, that are wearing a MAGA hat.
Yeah, you're confusing.
I think so.
And you are, I think you're confusing. You look like you should be one thing, and then when you look at the boxes you check, you definitely should be the thing. And you're like, no, I'm not really that. I also think you seem like a person who's not, you don't really give a fuck. So you're not going to be defined by what everybody else thinks you should be anyways. And you're smart.
Thank you. I mean, at this point, I don't really give a fuck. If you had talked to me a few years ago, I was much more crouched and much more scared because I felt like I had to cling to the certain world that I thought was the only world that I could live in and work in and date in and be a part of. And now, you know, like Barstool being an amazing example of this, it's clear to me that we're living in a time where new worlds are being created and, you know, that it became more of an option for me to peace out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Barry, let's talk about that. Like, give us the Cliff Notes version. And for people who aren't familiar with you, give the sense of your former career and trajectory.
So you might know me as the girl that, like, Jerry Maguire'd my way out of the New York Times with it. Probably, if you know anything about me, it's that I wrote a resignation letter that I'm pretty damn proud of.
Slightly public resignation letter.
Yeah. So the short answer is I'm pretty boring, to be honest with you. I'm the oldest of four daughters. I grew up in the Jewish community of Pittsburgh. My parents are high school sweethearts. My dad's a political conservative. My mom is a liberal. I left Pittsburgh, went to Columbia University, started sort of writing then inadvertently. I hadn't planned on being a writer. I thought maybe vaguely I'd be a lawyer. But long story short, I was super politically active at Columbia. I used to debate campus socialists and things like that. I found out about this internship at the Wall Street Journal through a very serendipitous story in which Brett Stevens, who was my colleague at the Journal and then my colleague later at the New York Times, his father showed up at one of my debates and told me about this thing called the Wall Street Journal, which I had really not read. I thought it was just a financial newspaper, and told me I should go intern there. And that was really the start of my journalism career. So I spent a bunch of years at the Wall Street Journal, both on the op-ed page where I was an op-ed editor, and then on the book review section. And for people who don't read it, it's the only conservative editorial page in the country. And I was very much seen as sort of the leftmost flank crazy, you know, in the context of the Wall Street Journal, Bernie type person. I was seen as the squish. And then following the sort of shocking, at least in the context of the New York Times, election of Donald Trump, I was kind of an intellectual diversity hire. So I went from being the leftmost flank of a conservative editorial page to the rightmost flank inside the context of the New York Times, which if you spent any time actually in this country, the idea that I would be on the right of anything seems crazy, but that's where our institutions are. So suffice it to say, I came there super pumped. Like, this was a huge opportunity.
Can I interrupt you, Barry? Did you think you were a token hire, and did you care?
Like a token CEO, you might say.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, yes. I mean, people at the paper thought, wait, our job is to tell people about the world as it is, not the world as they wish it would be. Our job is to hold up a mirror to the country, not just hold up a mirror to Brooklyn and the Upper West Side and Berkeley. So let's bring in, let's first of all cover things differently. And let's also bring in people on the editorial page and the op-ed section who can solicit pieces from people with alternative points of view. People who might think to themselves, the New York Times would never allow my view in there. So that was my job. My job was to bring in obviously to write my own pieces, but the majority of my job was to bring in pieces from people who would not otherwise appear in the New York Times. Heterodox thinkers, libertarians, conservatives, high schoolers, first-time writers, people like that. So did I have a trouble being an intellectual token? Not really. I mean, it's the New York Times.
No, you're like that's my job. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, like yeah. It's even if you hate the New York Times and you think it's, you know, lying and you think it's a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party, whatever you think, it's still the New York Times. It's still the most powerful amplification system in the world. And so the opportunity to share my views, let alone bring in views that wouldn't otherwise appear in there, better believe I like leapt at that opportunity.
So you take advantage of it. Like, does someone eat lunch with you on the first day, or was it like daggers from the minute you walked in?
I mean, there were certainly people there who were lovely, and one of them being my wife, who I met at the New York Times. So, I mean, I'll always be eternally grateful for meeting her. I met her like on the fifth floor in the little coffee cafeteria room. So there's plenty of people that I like at the New York Times, and there's plenty of journalists who I deeply admire at the New York Times. I wouldn't know about what's going on in places like China or Afghanistan if it weren't for the New York Times. So there's so many good things I can say. And one of the reasons that I am so pained about what's going on there is precisely because I think it's such an important institution. But no, Erica, like from the beginning, you know, there were gradations, right? There were certain people who were nice to me, other people who treated me sort of like a curiosity. And then, you know, unfortunately, there were colleagues of mine who, you know, had no hesitation to openly smear me or, you know, when they were being nice, subtweet me on Twitter. And, you know, there were certain colleagues who refused to speak to me the whole time I worked there.
And how did you develop thick skin on that? Like, are you the same person you were?
No.
6 years ago? Like, how are you different?
Well, I mean, if I look back on my life, there is something consistent in my personality, whether or not that personality is nature or the value my parents raised me with. I'm sure it's a combination of the two. Allowed me to go against the grain in many areas of my life. Like, I would definitely say that was a consistent theme, but I would be lying to you if I didn't say that the kind of pressure that I experienced in that context, and certainly online, and the way that I became a kind of, I don't know, avatar or like two-dimensional version of myself on the internet, is extremely painful. I mean, anyone that's lived through any kind of enormous public criticism or even public shaming will tell you that there's something almost like physical about it. So am I different now? Of course I'm different now. I'm, you know, I care less about what people think, which I think is a good thing. I think the thing that I try and protect myself from doing, and I see that this has happened to many, many people I know who have, you know, been feature characters in the online culture war, is that you want to try not to harden yourself and close your mind and, like, without sounding cheesy about it, like, harden your heart. And like, it's very important to me that I remain vulnerable and remain open, and mm-hmm. I'm capable of changing my mind. And one of the things that I think is scary about the current cultural context that we're living in is that there's no room for second chances. There's no room for evolution. There's no room for forgiveness. Everything that you've done for all of your life, especially for those digital natives, like the Gen Z people, it's there forever. And like, mm-hmm. it's just not healthy to live in that kind of panopticon. Can I say that I've, you know, that I'm somehow floating above it? No, I'm as victim to it. And as victim's not the right word, I'm as subject to it as any other human being. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting, the dichotomy of, also your vocabulary is amazing, but the dichotomy of wanting to stay open and vulnerable and in touch, right? Because I think that is something of what you did bring to the times, is you could access a part of the world, and then, and frankly, not the world, this country, that they could not see. Like the Times has, in my opinion, lost eyes for reality. Yes. In some ways, because it doesn't fit the definition and the narrative, which I want to get to in a second. But the juxtaposition between staying open and being vulnerable is an invitation for mistake. And that yet we live in a world where you can't make mistakes. Like, how do you stay open now? Like, how you've been through a war to a degree that I think is very hard to describe. But how do you do it? What would your advice to other people be?
I would not say that I've lived through a war. I mean, anyone like AOC lived through a war on January 6th. But was that traumatizing? Yes. Did I live through some kind of trauma? Yes. But I also... And this is one of my answers to your question. Like, I really try and keep it in perspective. And, you know, when I think about my life and the freedoms that I have and the opportunities that I have, like, in the span of, like, American history, Jewish history, human history, I'm like...
Yeah, like, you're okay.
Luckiest person that ever lived. Like, I can wear a tank top and be married to my wife and walk down the street and not get stoned. That is a much better position
Things
than the
are
vast
good.
Majority of people in the world. And I think one of the problems right now is that, and it's understandable, like, we are genuinely living an information revolution that's transforming our brains and transforming the way we relate to each other and transforming what it means to be human. The last big time that happened, like 14th century printing press, like, it led to massive seismic changes and major world wars. So it is very normal that we would be having, you know, a reaction and a major shift given, you know, this device we're talking to each other through right now. That said, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. like, I think it's important to keep perspective. I think it's important to root down into real life, you know, like, there's something about this that is both amazing and also extremely flattening, and people become like a sort of like a slice of themselves rather than a whole person. And so I think part of it is mm-hmm. like being as much in real life as possible, feeling being connected to community and family and friends. That's like, I couldn't maintain my sanity, let alone like be involved in the controversial topics that I am without that. But like everyone else, I'm really trying to figure it out, because it's really hard to, how do you resist the algorithm? Like, it's like saying mm-hmm. to someone, like, stand alone on a beach and a tsunami's just going to come hit you again and again and again, but just stand up. Like, it's an impossible ask.
Stay upright.
It's not yep. possible. What we can do is yep. look back at history, understand the things that have generally worked for human beings in the past, and try as much as we can to anchor ourselves in those qualities and in those virtues. Like, let me say one more thing on this. I find it very strange that in the year 2021, I need to be going out in public making the argument that people should be judged not based on the sins of their parents, not based on the amount of melanin in their skin, not based on their group identity, but based on who they are as people. Like, that suddenly has become an argument that needs to be made, because that very basic thing that so many Americans fought and died to make real is now under siege again. Like, I don't know if people have fully appreciated the extent to which like liberalism broadly defined, like those kind of values, second chances, mercy, justice, proportion, you know, that those are the things that are under siege. And like, if I really get to the kind of like root of why I had to leave the New York Times, beyond the bullying and beyond the self-censorship and all the things I'm sure we'll talk about, it's that I feel that the fight for those values is the fight of our lifetime. And I knew that I couldn't wage that battle inside an institution that had already capitulated to the ideology.
Speaking of Barry getting the shit kicked out of her in the New York Times newsroom, let's talk about Lightboxer. So Lightboxer is the first workout routine that you will actually want to do. It's an at-home boxing experience. It's not another heavy bag. So what's great about it is that not only do you get the bag, but you get music, expert training, and technology. Their integrated display shows you when and where to punch. If you're a little bit clumsy like I am, it's actually a great way to figure out how to box. What's also very cool is the music is choreographed with the trainer classes and challenges, so you can make your own playlist or you can enjoy their curated playlist. Real-time results track your progress so you can get stronger and fitter over time. Whether or not you have ever put on a pair of boxing gloves, Lightboxer is an awesome workout that you can get at home. Go to lightboxer.com/token and get $100 off your purchase. Very well put. So talk about what you're doing now and how you are going to fight for those values. Like, talk about, you know, what's interesting to me about the New York Times a little bit is the hypocrisy that the New York Times is about truth, right? When you look at the advertisements for the New York Times, if you're at a bus stop or you're reading the full print ad, they're only in New York City and Berkeley, to your point. But the second is they market themselves as a source of truth. But in reality, I think your experience was frankly nearly opposite to that. And I think what's interesting about brands like Barstool and us and me is that, you know, no one here ever said they were a journalist. No one here ever said we were an authority on anything. But yet we were very real and authentic and earnest to a degree about how we covered it, and we understood the audience and what the audience wanted. So how do you think about the transition that you've now made to Substack and your podcast? Like, are you like, wow, I could be a bigger force here than I could inside The Gray Lady? Like, talk about that transition.
Yeah, well, to your point, I would say that part of the confusion and maybe even grief that people are feeling is that it's not just the New York Times, you know, it's publishing houses, it's Harvard, it's Yale, it's all of these institutions that still have the same font or logo or, you know, high-minded slogan, like that on the surface, they seem to be what they've always been. But if you look under the hood, they've transformed themselves. And in the case of the Times, you know, the slogan is still all the news that's fit to print, but you just pick it up and you know that it's actually all the news that fits the narrative. You know, the slogan is the truth is hard and we need to track it down and, you know, we need to strive for it even if it's inconvenient. That's not actually the slogan, but it's basically like that. And the truth is more something like we're MSNBC in print. And in the exact same way that Fox gives its viewers a heroin hit of their, you know, brand of, you know, political drug, that's what the New York Times has become. The tragedy of this is, like, you know, you guys and Rogan, like, you say you're not authoritative, you say you're not journalists, and, you know, you are something different. The problem is we actually need journalism. Like, we need to know what's going on in Uyghur concentration camps. We need to know what's going on inside Apple, what's going on inside Google, what's going on in these major forces that are shaping the world that we live in. And so one of, like, the great efforts, I think, of this age needs to be, how can we rebuild institutions that are immune to the takeover of this ideology, that can stay true to the values of, you know, pursuing the truth, and that are authoritative? Like, what happens in a world where there are no sources of authority? Well, we know what it is, because no one trusts the CDC. because no one trusts the New York Times, because no one trusts, we could go down the list, politicians, et cetera. Like, it's not a great situation. It feels like we're in this like world that's being retribalized. And I think that's really dangerous. The part that I'm trying to play to my, in the little way that I am so far, is I'm trying to kind of pick up that flag that I feel like has been put down by so many others. And it's beginning with a newsletter, and I'm launching a podcast shortly that tries to have honest conversations, that tries to tell stories that are inconvenient, that tries to look at things even when they're ugly and try to understand what's really driving them. Like, super basic in a way, but that's what I'm trying to do. And if I'm successful, I hope that the newsletter and my podcast are really only the beginning of that effort.
And what do you think happens with the Times?
I think the Times, I think in general.
As a, that ilk, right?
Yeah, tradition. So I think what happens to the Times is that, you know, its business model is really working for it. If, like, let's just think about it, right? We're living in a world where everyone has to please their audience and everyone has to engage their audience. Well, should we be surprised that in that world, you know, in which something like between 90 and 95% of New York Times readers identify as Democrats or liberals, that they're going to run still into the Biden administration op-eds about Donald Trump? Of course not. Any more than we should be surprised that, like, you know, Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity are going to want to do stories about campus.
Everybody knows their audience.
It's all the same model, right? And like, no one's come up with a good solution yet to that model. I feel it even in myself, right? I know the kind of stories that I can run on my newsletter that are going to be red meat for my readers. And the question is, like, how does anyone resist like being captured by their audience? It takes a tremendous amount of discipline. I do not think the New York Times is turning around. I think it's going to go further and further and further down this direction. And I think it's important. I think the good thing that will happen is that a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, no one's going to pretend anymore that it's the paper of record. That gap between the advertisement and the truth is going to become more clear. And I think people are going to appreciate, you know, this is a paper you read if you're a coastal liberal elite, in the same way that, like, if you pick up, you know, the Daily Mail versus the Guardian in England, those are two different kinds of people. And maybe that's maybe that kind of honesty is better.
Do you think there's a market for what you have to say? Like, if, you know, Fox is catering to one side of the aisle, the Times is catering to the other, you want to live without a box, right? You're living in the middle. You want to bring in diverse points of view. Why is that? What I think is going to be interesting is, can that audience in the middle be super served, right? Like, people, when they attack us, they say that there's the Barstool Republicans, right? Which is basically to say young, disenfranchised white men. And I'm like, look, there's a great business to be built for young, disenfranchised white men and women and young, disenfranchised people in general, which is, I think, where you're going. So how will you run your future media empire in a way where you don't fall into
those traps?
Well,
that's why I want to talk to you. That's why. That's
all right.
I want your advice. I've never tried to build a business of my own. I guess I would say that what I'm doing now is the same thing that I did at the Times, but I'm doing it on my newsletter, and it's doing unbelievably well so far, like well beyond my expectations. Maybe this is going to sound radical to people, but I just really believe that the world of these 20th century institutions is not going to be the world of the 21st century. And when I look and see, like, you know, it's like, just pick up the New York Times, right? Like, I remember at the height of this summer, one of the cover business stories was about the cultural appropriation of tiki bars. Like, you know, there's still a popular feature that's like, what did you miss last night on late night? Like, I don't know a single person that watches those shows. And
nobody's
yet, like, the only piece that ran in the paper on Rogan was an interview that I did with him after the acquisition by Spotify. Like, he has more cultural power and cachet than every single person combined on CNN. So, like, that's where the world is going. When it comes to journalists, like, present company excluded, some of the most interesting, independent-minded, like, enterprising reporters and commentators, they're not in the institutions. They're on Substack. So like, what would a world look like where there was more of like a federation of those kind of independent minded journalists? Mm-hmm. That's where I'm mm-hmm. sort of like looking toward. The question is yeah. like, how do you build something with a lot of disagreeable, heterodox, contrarian people? Because the very thing that makes us immune to being swept along by whatever prevailing orthodoxy, the very thing that made us self-deport from that world, is also the thing that makes it hard for us to collaborate with one another.
To unify completely. Are you selling t-shirts yet?
No, but I need swag, don't I?
You need to have a t-shirt. You need to be like, I'm with Barry, or what's your thing? Like, you got to have it for a t-shirt.
It's common sense. I mean, it's news for
you. Got to ignite your cult.
It's
okay. What is it, Barry? Hit me with
okay,
your.
I'll give you a few things because I'm not settled yet.
Okay, it's got to be short, Barry. It's got to be
a reality based community. Okay.
No.
Common sense for normal people.
That works.
You know, fearless.
How about like a checkbox common sense?
Okay, I love it. I love it. See, this is why I need you. I need to talk to the
Okay, this is great. We should
CEO.
Make you a t-shirt line.
I need t-shirts.
You should have a t-shirt line.
I need t-shirts. I need hats. I need all the swag. Like, honestly, for right now, yeah. I'm just, like, dealing with a gusher of stories that in any normal situation would be appearing in places like the Washington Post and CNN and the New York Times. And, like, me and my, like, little staff of consulting editors need to put it out on my Substack. So my
Do you have like a tips line? Is that how you're like, are you still a feeder? You're just a feeder for yourself.
You have a tips line? I mean, the tips line is my inbox and my email.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Is it
it's called
tips?
BarryWeiss@gmail.com for now, but we're working on getting an official tips line because I just can't keep up. And some of them I farm out. Like, there's too many stories that are just not being covered and too many scoops. So some of them I give to people like broadly inside of that independent network that I'm referring to.
Barry, you're going to have really big business. Yeah, I do.
So.
I think you need a business person. You hired your sister from the
She's
Post.
She's the best.
What's it like working with your sister?
It's amazing. She's brilliant. So I hired my sister from the Post, who's like, she's just an incredible reporter and she's extremely funny. And then I also hired another New York Times refugee, Andy Mills, who built a lot of the podcasts at the New York Times. So like going back to a question you asked before about like what has allowed me to have thick skin. I grew up in a mixed marriage. Like my dad's a conservative. My mom's a liberal. My mother withheld sex in 2016 and in 2020 to make sure my dad wouldn't vote for Trump. And he like wrote in Steph Curry or my mom or something. Like that's the family context that I'm coming from. So I'm extremely comfortable like disagreeing with people and like loving them at the end of the day. And it terrifies me that is now something that seems endangered in this country. And I just think most Americans love people that disagree with them. And I think most Americans are what I think of as like purple people. Like they're not deep red, they're not deep blue. They're somewhere in the middle. They take things issue by issue and they don't want to live in a world where everyone's divided according to who they vote for and like whether or not they have pronouns in their bio.
Why do you think there's such a witch hunt for purity and just this severe alignment and where does that come from? Like you talk about it as like liberalism, but where does that come from? Like I feel it. I've stepped in shit so many times in the last 6 years. And it's like, sometimes I'm like, I literally just trying to buy lunch for a hockey team, but apparently I'm a misogynist. But like how, to me, I just am always mystified that the idea of being politically correct actually means being pure. And I don't believe that anyone is pure. I think everyone makes mistakes. I think being flawed is the most beautiful thing out there. It's what makes people interesting. It's what makes us human. And I agree with you. I think, you know, just sitting from a comedy, you know, as a comedy brand, it's getting extremely difficult, if not outright impossible, to be funny. I mean, you talk to any comedian, you talk to any comic, it's challenging. You, the comedy can make you uncomfortable. It makes you think. A joke helps you remember something. And the idea of making a joke that is so offensive. So where do you think this comes from?
That's the very deepest question. For those who haven't read him, I would recommend all of Jonathan Haidt's books, but especially The Righteous Mind and The Coddling of the American Mind. I think I got those titles right. I think it's coming broadly from two places. One is we're living through a time of unbelievable transformation, economic and informational. And I think that leads to a, you know, if you look at the metrics, yes, lots of things in life are getting better. And yet it always feels like we're on edge, right? It feels like it's like Y2K every day, or like the fear of Y2K.
Totally.
And I think the reason for that is this, like, the digital revolution, the information revolution, and that kind of precarity and sense of like, whoa, like things aren't as they appeared to be, and things are unequal, and things, you know, like, why should it be so hard for me to struggle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, leads people to like a fear-based mindset. Like, I think when people retribalize, a lot of that is driven by a sense of fear and a sense of like openness to other people is somehow like dangerous for you. So I think that's part of it. I think the other thing, and lots of people way smarter than me have said this in a more articulate way, is like the untold consequences of the death of religion and living in a, you know, technically we're living in a secularized society, but it doesn't feel like that, right? It feels like people are actually like extremely orthodox, and that those religious inclinations that in healthy religion is harnessed, you know, in service to other people, is harnessed, you know, for giving people mercy and grace, right now is not being harnessed. And instead that kind of like religious impulse that like you see in a, like the Salem witch trials, or you see really throughout history, that's what's rearing its head in ours. Like, the religious impulse doesn't go away if people don't go to church. It just gets channeled in another direction. And
it's just getting applied
in politics, where that's, and like in the culture war, where that is becoming people's church. And in a way that's actually like far more dangerous, I think. And just less, I don't know. It's like people need meaning and people need belonging. And if they're not going to find it in healthy ways, and if they're not going to find it in like the Rotary clubs and the churches and the synagogues that don't exist anymore, they're going to find it in bands of people on Reddit and on Twitter. And that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you, you talked about how there was a time where you were crouching, right? Where you physically embodied a lot of what you're talking about from a societal perspective. You are under siege. You know, you're getting hammered on the Slack, you're getting hammered on Twitter, you're getting hammered from your bosses, from your readers, from readers who hate you, from people who've never read you or heard of you, but people are piling on, so why not? How did you make that transition personally to being more fearless and to caring less or caring more? Like, that's what I like about you. I'm like, you care a lot, but I think you
also care so much.
Yeah, you care a lot.
I care so much. Like, I am in a way a really sensitive person. You know, I'm proud of myself when I look back on the things I published at the Times, because as scared as I often was, I did live by my values, even inside of the New York Times. Like, I really, really did that. It's just, it brought a lot of heat my way, but I always did it. I think the thing that has changed for me is, first of all, being in a context where people aren't like calling for you to be fired in Slack channels with thousands of colleagues, or like putting axe and guillotine emojis next to your name. Like, that's just a healthier, better life. So I think.
Seems like a better workplace environment. You know, what did HR say? Sorry. Did you ever go to HR? I can't remember if you covered this.
I didn't.
Sorry, I don't mean to insult you.
You don't need to go to HR when the thing is happening in front of the publisher and the editor of the newspaper. Like, they're in that Slack channel praising people for their moral courage.
The HR people are, like, doubling down on the fire and, guillotine
emojis.
And
the other funny thing about the Times is people are like, tell me what went on. And I'm like, I don't need to tell you. Go on Twitter. It all happens in public. Like, it's a very strange a thing. I think that being clear with myself about what my values are, and frankly, like, what I'm willing to leave a prestigious job for, what I'm willing to lose friends for, what I'm willing to, like, you know, in my small way, sacrifice for, but in a grander scale, like, really asking yourself, like, what is your life about? And what are you willing to give it up for? Or at least give up parts of it that seem crazy to other people. I know what those things are for me. And so the more I'm able to, like, keep those at the forefront of my mind, the more I'm able to be courageous to the extent that I'm able to be courageous. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say to, like, you know, when you're referencing, and I know so many of them because we're living out in LA, like the comedians that are scared to tell jokes, or the people that are really living, like, different lives in public than they are in private, that should be enough evidence for people that we're going down a very bad direction. If you feel that you can't tell a joke in private, if you feel you can't take a risk in terms of speech, if you can't actually exercise free speech anymore, like, it turns out, like, we don't need a dictator to have a version of totalitarianism. All we need is Twitter and a bunch of cowards running the most important institutions in the culture. Take as evidence, like, it's enough evidence that we've gone far enough down a bad path that you're scared to speak out loud. Speak now mm-hmm. while you can. Like, I have absolutely committed myself to that, no matter what. And, like, people didn't die on the beaches of Normandy so that I would be scared to say basic commonsensical positions on the internet. And, like, I just would beseech everyone that, like, again, like, that's what makes this country at its best exceptional, and not just exceptional right now in the world, but exceptional in human history with all of our flaws. And we're obligated to tell the truth. Like, I really believe that. And, like, if the hardest thing that's being asked of us is to get ratioed online, like, we're in a pretty good situation.
We're okay. Yep. Barry, speak now while you can would be a great t-shirt.
That would be.
From the Barry
Weiss
collection. Teacher.
I feel like my friend Bridget Fetisi has something similar, so I have to check. I got to check.
Okay.
I have to check if she's trademarked
it. I'm going to go make you a t-shirt one, I think. Okay, you should. Oh, yeah, you got to get on the trademarking
business for all your slogans. I appreciate your passion for swag.
For t-shirts? For slack or t-shirts?
For t-shirts.
Oh, I love swag. Swag matters, Barry. It's how you create your tribe.
I know.
If you're going to make the normal central people who are like, sometimes I like to make jokes, sometimes I like this, sometimes I like that. If you got to give them an identity so they can fight all the weirdos on the fringe.
Right.
That is your job.
My God, I'm going to schedule a meeting tonight with my team of three to talk about t-shirts.
Do it. All right. Barry Weiss, thank you so much. You are an inspiration. I appreciate you doing this so much. I'm following up with you and I'll be sending you some t-shirts.
I can't wait. I'll wear them with pride.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Good
Erica.
Luck. All right.
Bye.
Bye, girl.
All right. So before we let you guys go, we always like to talk about High Noon. High Noon is how we end this episode. High Noon is a hard seltzer made with real vodka, real juice, and sparkling water. They just launched their limited edition tropical 8-pack. I've actually had a hard time getting my hands on this. They've got flavors like mango, passion fruit, watermelon, and pineapple, in addition to the fan favorites of cherry, grapefruit, lime, and my personal favorite, peach. All flavors are available in 4-packs. They also have an 8-pack variety pack. Only 100 calories, tastes delicious, gluten-free with no added sugar. We've got like 8 bloggers on the road from Dallas, Texas, back to the Jersey Shore on our High Noon Barstool versus the World summer tour. So you should check that out while you have a chance. And I'm going to hand it to Marina, who is rightfully rooting for the Bruins tonight.
My one fucking good thing is that Dave Portnoy has decided to shift the venue of the live streams for the Bruins Islanders game back to Boston. We're heading to Boston for game 3 and 4. Let's go. Go Bruins. That's my one fucking good thing. To go watch our live streams, head to BarstoolSports.com, or you can find us on the Barstool Sportsbook on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, wherever. Come find us.
All right, that's it for today's episode. If you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast, leave us a rating, or give us a review. Tonight, we've got the Bruins versus the Islanders. The Borellis are broken up. Everyone is going to Boston to watch the stream or to be on the stream. The PLL kicks off tomorrow night. So for any lacrosse fans out there, my guy Paul Rabel and his new team, the Boston Cannons, or what used to be called the Boston Cannons, kick off their season against the Redwoods at 7 p.m. They're playing at Gillette Stadium. I'm going to be there. You can also watch on Peacock on Peacock. I'm at EKA Nardini. Token CEO is on Twitter and Instagram. And you can also find us on TikTok, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And we'll see you back here on Tuesday.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save big.